28. The pain came in waves, soaking deep into him with each surge. He couldn't sort any of it into a rational order. There were just the flashes of agony and the moments of sensory recall that jumbled into a mess of sound, color, and smell. Blood and chemical cleaner stink. Hard, bright light that prickled like needles. A horrible, drug-fogged sense of dislocation. Mark rose up through the levels of awareness from the black, abyssal depths, like a swimmer pushing toward the surface of an infinite sea. The real world gradually sketched itself in around him, starting with the feel of cotton against his body, of clothing and sheets and the steady pressure of a mattress against his back. There was noise, the soft and steady chimes of a heart monitor, the low rush of voices like distant breakers, and the faint medicinal odor he associated with sickness and death. His eyes opened and he saw a hospital room of pale greens and cream. Shadows of nighttime cast through the window blinds. Mark heard a woman speak. "He's awake. Call Langley." It was an effort to shift his weight, and when he did, he realized he felt cold all down one side. Mark reached for the place where that burning, shrieking pain had cut into him in the reflection pool and found a wad of bandages, the outer layer dotted with tiny spots of blood. The dark sea came up again, and for Mark the transition seemed to happen instantly. One moment it was night, and when his eyes opened again a heartbeat later, the room was filled with honey-gold morning light. The doctor leaned away from him, and his eyes fixed on a single detail. She had a military identity tag on her white coat. "He's all yours," she told someone and stepped out of the room. Mark blinked and focused as a man came into view. He wore a dark suit and a plain tie, with the bland, good looks of a mid-list television actor, the sort of person who might play the handsome husband on a soap opera. The man put a cup of water on the bedside table and gave Mark an appraising look.
"Welcome back, Mr. Dane. How are you feeling?"
Mark realized how thirsty he was, and he gulped down the water.
"Like 50 miles of bad road," he managed. "Being shot will do that," said someone else, and Mark blinked, finding a second man standing at the back of the room. Although he was dressed similarly to his associate, this guy was more muscular. He'd be the thug ex-boyfriend of the pretty female lead.
He shook off the mental image. Mark was still a little dopey from whatever drugs had been pumped into his system, and his train of thought was in danger of running off the tracks.
How long was I out of it?
"You've been sleeping in R for 3 days, said the first man. "I'm Cahill, and that's my colleague, Durant. You have some questions to answer."
The background tension of pain in Mark's side was returning as his body gradually woke up. He shifted position and winced.
"Where am I?"
"Walter Reed Medical Center," said Cahill.
"Under guard," added Durant.
Mark took this in. Walter Reed was a military hospital a few miles outside of Washington, D.C., and if he was there, it meant that there was a ring of army steel surrounding him. It was likely that no one outside would have the first clue about his location. He studied Cahill, trying to get a handle on his situation.
"So, you lads aren't Homeland Security. I'd say CIA at a push."
Durant turned to look at him.
"We are the people holding your scrawny neck in our hands. That clear enough?"
Mark glanced at Cahill.
"Are you actually doing the good cop, bad cop thing?"
Cahill smiled slightly.
"Why mess with the classics?"
He took a seat near the bed, while Durant hovered nearby.
"A lot of people want to talk to you, Mark. Can I call you Mark?"
He didn't wait for him to reply.
"There's a long list of folks who you've pissed off."
Mark settled against the headrest, catching sight of his pulse, flicking up and down on the medical monitor. It was smoother than he expected, even though calm was the last thing he should have been. He chalked it up to the soporific effects of the medication and said nothing. Silence was always a powerful weapon in the push and pull of any interrogation.
"We know all about you," Durant offered. "We got your computer. Your phones.
Nice work there, by the way, said Cahill. Our tech guys are cursing a blue streak trying to break through the encryption you have on that laptop.
So, continued the other agent, that puts us in a difficult position. You're a real problem, you and your friend Keyes.
At the mention of Lucy's name, he tensed.
Where is she?
Alive. Well, in cuffs, snapped Durant. Like the convict she is.
Mark's brow furrowed. Had he misheard?
Convict.
Durant nodded.
Guess she don't talk about that much, huh? Keyes is a federal fugitive.
On the road from New Jersey, she had talked about being on a wanted list. Mark hadn't pressed the issue, surmising that she had gone AWOL from her army career. But Durant's manner suggested something else entirely. Before he could digest that, Cahill was talking again.
Let's look at what we have. Mark Dane, rogue British intelligence officer, disavowed by his own government and wanted by Interpol. Lucille Keyes, a disgraced former Delta Force sniper and escaped prisoner, both in our custody after attempting to disrupt a major security operation involving the President of these United States.
Disrupt is not the word that I would use, Mark managed.
Cahill went on. We have two dead men disguised as police officers. One is an ex-NCO in the South African Army, who apparently took the quick way down from the roof of the Willard Hotel in downtown D.C. The other, shot dead at close range in the hotel maintenance room, is a man with a kind of deliberately fragmented record in the British military that usually indicates a special forces operator. Then there's our other two prisoners. A known criminal with ties to several private military contractors and the other. He trailed off. A Saudi national with a permanent spot on Homeland Security's watch list, said Durant, his tone severe. An operative of the Al-Saif terror group.
Cahill nodded.
We're in the process of rounding up more. A group of mercenaries who entered the country illegally on a ship that docked in New Jersey. You know something about that?
Mark could feel a steady pressure building behind his eyes, like the onset of a migraine headache.
Did it happen? He asked, the question falling out of him. The bombs. Did they go off?
They didn't detonate, Durant replied. And right now, nobody even knows they were there.
A wave of relief washed over him.
That's good.
Durant shook his head.
Not for you.
Here's how I think it went, said Cahill, gesturing with one hand. You and Keyes are on the outs, and you got recruited into this nasty little plot cooked up by Al-Saif. But you both got cold feet. You couldn't go through with it, so you turned on your pals. You wanted to make yourselves the heroes of the day.
Mark looked away, incredulous at the agent's reading of the situation.
What I want is answers. I want Jadid Amara and Omar Kadir.
The mention of Kadir's name sent a charge through the room as Cahill and Durant exchanged glances.
And I didn't want anyone else to die, Mark concluded.
Amara's not going to be getting any visitors, Durant told him. Ever. He's going to a place that makes Gitmo look like Club Med. And he'll be there for a long time.
We did what we did to stop them, Mark pressed on. People I care about were killed. The life I had was torn up. My family were threatened.
He summoned the strength to glare at the agents.
That's not something I was going to let slide, you get me?
So, out of the goodness of your hearts, you and Keyes came all the way to D.C. to warn us about a terror strike.
Cahill leaned in. Couldn't just phone it in like a concerned citizen.
Mark shot him an acid look.
Don't take the piss.
His jaw hardened.
I'm not saying anything else until I see Lucy.
Durant scowled, and at a look from Cahill, he produced a phone from his pocket and dialed a number. Mark heard another phone ring off down the hospital corridor.
Bring her in, he said.
A moment later, Lucy stepped through the door. She looked more tired than he had ever seen her, but she managed a wan smile, and without waiting for permission, she crossed to a chair and dropped into it.
Mark couldn't miss the rigid frame cuffs binding her wrists.
"Pardon me if I don't shake hands," she said. Her manner softened briefly. "You okay?"
"I'm okay," he replied.
"Liar."
"Yeah." Mark rubbed at his eyes. "The carriers. What happened to them?"
"They're here," said Lucy. "After the rally ended, everyone went home, and they were still there, standing in a line, waiting, just like Amara told them to."
"We detained all of the bombers," said Cahill. "The devices have been successfully removed and made safe by an EOD team. No fatalities, although the young men are still hospitalized."
"What's going to happen to them?" said Mark. "I mean, they're just teenagers, conditioned to be nothing better than a walking delivery system. They're not enemy combatants. They're victims."
"You sure of that?" asked Durant.
"They scooped up the kid from the diner, too, Halil," added Lucy. "I think the State Department are going to get involved. Some of them are classed as minors under U.S. law."
Mark turned a hard glare on Cahill, and the agent raised an eyebrow, preempting his next words.
"Despite what you may have heard about my agency, we're not in the business of waterboarding children. They'll be interviewed and taken care of. The real issue at hand is you two."
Mark glanced at Lucy.
"You told them the truth."
She didn't respond.
"I'd like to know why our agency is getting pressure from members of the Senate about your detention," said Durant, the question coming from nowhere. "You got friends in high places, Dane. Friends who all seem to share a connection to the same international multi-billion-dollar corporation."
He came closer.
"What's the deal with you and Rubicon?" "That's a question I'd really like answered."
Cahill shot his colleague a look, silencing him.
"I'm going to cut to the chase. This is how things are going to go."
He stood up, and his veneer of civility faded away.
"Mark, you're going to be interrogated for every last piece of information you know about Al-Saif and their attempted bombing of the education rally. When we're done with you, you'll be extradited back to the UK where your own people want to have words."
He turned to Lucy. "Miss Keyes, we'll make certain you go right back to the same cell you vacated at Miramar Penal Barracks, where you'll serve out the remainder of your sentence along with several extra years for all the other crimes you committed in the meantime."
Cahill's expression became impassive. "If you two have any last words you want to share, now's the time. After today, you won't see each other again. Hell, you'll be lucky if you even see daylight."
Lucy forced that tired smile once more.
"I'm sorry, Dane."
But Mark shook his head.
"No." "No what?" said Durant. "I mean, no. That's not how this is going to be."
Mark leaned forward, ignoring the tightening of his still raw wounds, meeting Cahill's gaze.
"I don't like that narrative. I got a much better one."
Cahill was turning to leave the room.
"You don't get to dictate terms." "The Combine."
Mark let the name fall where it lay.
"The what?"
Durant feigned ignorance.
"I told you before, don't take the piss," Mark retorted.
"Don't pretend you never heard of them. Just makes you look stupid."
He grunted softly, the ache from the injuries putting his teeth on edge.
"If you know about Al-Saif, you know about the Combine, and if you know about them, you know they supplied hardware for a dozen different terror attacks."
"That we're aware of," Lucy added.
Cahill hesitated.
"I'm listening. I'll bet the Central Intelligence Agency is as concerned as MI6 are about Combine penetration," said Mark.
"So a file full of metadata showing locations, dates, and origins of communications between Combine assets would be of great interest."
"Dane," Lucy's tone was a warning, "what are you doing?"
"I'm changing the game."
He drew himself up.
"You're going to let us walk, Cahill. Free and clear."
"We are?"
Durant towered over Mark.
"Why the hell would we do that?"
"Let him talk," said Cahill.
Mark went on. "There's a remote server containing every last bit of data I pulled from the records of one Dima Novakovic. He was a broker for the Combine, until he ended up surplus to requirements. He met Durant's gaze. I'll put the intel there for safekeeping. I'll give you the password you need to access it. Durant cocked his head.
I'm pretty sure I could beat that out of you.
He leaned in, radiating menace.
That bad cop enough?
There are two passwords, Mark said, holding firm. You won't know which one I've given you until you try it. The wrong one instantly kills the contents of the server memory, and you get bugger all. He looked away from Durant to the other man. Now, here's the thing. There are Combine Ghost assets inside the CIA, and you know it. If you say no to my offer, I'll know you're one of them, because anyone else is going to jump at the chance to help the company clean house. Cahill smiled thinly.
That's very clever. It's what he's good at, Lucy said warily. Even if it does get him into trouble.
There's a bonus, too, Mark went on. I'll provide enough information on Al-Saif's attack for you lads to make it look like it was you who thwarted attempted mass murder. The CIA gets the glory and an excuse for all that black budget money you suck up. He stopped, then snapped his fingers as something else occurred to him. I'll even throw in the reason why the Navy lost one of their drones last week for free. Durant folded his arms and glared at Cahill.
You're not seriously considering this bullshit.
Hypothetically speaking, Cahill replied, if the agency accepted such an offer, there would be stipulations. He paused, considering Mark. It's fair to say you've earned the displeasure of this nation. If you came across our radar again, there would be serious consequences. Cahill glanced at Lucy. And as for you, Miss Keyes, consider your citizenship revoked. All the rights and privileges you enjoy as an American will go away. You'll be stateless. Her expression soured. It's not like I was going to get my GI pension anyhow. She gave a shrug. Whatever. I'll manage.
I'm not done, said Mark. There's one more thing.
Sure there is, snorted Durant. You want a sleepover in the Lincoln bedroom, too.
I need something from the NSA's cryptanalysis division. Cahill gave a short, humorless chuckle.
Can't help you with that.
Yeah, you can, Mark insisted. Get Durant here to apply some pressure. He went on before the other agent could respond. I'm not going to be coy about it. Everyone knows that the NSA is monitoring email traffic through Europe and the UK.
Fucking WikiLeaks, said Durant under his breath.
Mark went on. That whole PRISM system your government swears is no big deal. The thing you're using to spy on everyone else, including your allies. I want it to work for me just one time.
Why?
Demanded Cahill.
I got my own ghost to hunt, Mark replied.
Cahill was silent for a long moment before he spoke again.
I'll need to make some calls.
No, you don't, said Lucy. The agency didn't send a man down here without the right kinds of clearance. You say it, it'll happen.
She looked toward Mark. That's if you're sure about this.
Solomon,
he can't give me what I need,
Mark replied, never taking his eyes off the CIA agent.
Do we have a deal?
Lunch in the Rapier Club's elegant dining room had done little to ameliorate Donald Royce's mood, and after retreating to the library for a glass of port and a look over the day's papers, he still hadn't been able to shake the unsettled feeling that lay upon him. He sat in a high-backed chair of old, well-maintained ox-blood leather, his gaze drifting to the dance of flames in the fireplace. Outside, London had turned wet and dismal, and the other members who wandered past him smelled rain damp and of cigars. He tried to lose himself in the cozy, controlled space of the club. Royce wanted to pretend that he could remain here until all his problems melted away, safe in this impenetrable bastion of English tradition. Around him, the rich and the well-connected, the captains of industry, the officer class, and the scions of landed gentry all went about their business as if nothing mattered to them. Inside the oak-panelled walls of the Rapier Club's lounges, privilege made time stand still. But it was a falsehood. On the other side of the antique windows, looking out onto Mayfair, the world moved on. There were threats out there,
that could reach into these hallowed halls as easily as anywhere else. Royce's job was to deal with them, of course, but recent events had made that task harder than ever to accomplish. Soon, Royce would be called up to Sir Oliver's office at Vauxhall Cross to present his final analysis of events that had begun with the sinking of the Palomino in Dunkirk and ended with the disappearance of Mark Dane somewhere in the Maryland countryside a week earlier. It was not a meeting he was looking forward to, just as it had not been a resolution that he could live with. Heads were going to roll. One thing after another had gone wrong, and now there were rumours coming across the Atlantic that the cousins were up to something. Royce flipped over the copy of the Times and saw a column on the front page. A journalist in Washington was reeling off some supposition about the American president and the war on terror. He scowled at the ill-informed piece and tossed the paper aside. "Sir?" Royce looked up to see one of the club's staff holding a small white envelope in his hand. The attendant wore black trousers and a red jacket with gold frogging, designed to mimic the look of a British Army uniform from the Crimean War.
"A message for you."
Inside the envelope were the details of one of the club's private meeting rooms, along with a name he had not expected to see. Royce forced a brittle smile and gave the attendant a generous tip. He paused just long enough to throw the note into the fireplace before he made for the stairs. The Alma Room was used for games of bridge, and while Royce never played, he had often seen other members engaged in lengthy sessions. One wall was a series of glass panels that led out onto an interior balcony, from which one could look down on the lobby to observe the comings and goings through the club's entrance. The room was broken up by pillars of pink marble between the antique card tables and overstuffed chairs. Victor Wells was the only other occupant. As Royce entered, he rose and gave him a disagreeable look.
"Donald," he said, without an iota of warmth.
"Here you are."
"I thought you detested this place," Royce replied. "What did you say about it?"
"A den for old men and plotters."
"Hidebound," Wells corrected.
"My exact words were a den for hidebound old men and plotters. That opinion hasn't changed. Believe me, if it wasn't that my family had a hereditary membership here, I'd never darken its doors."
He gestured at the walls.
"It's because of places like this and the old boy network they foster that my job exists. Makes it impossible to keep the system honest."
Royce went to a decanter on a nearby table and poured a glass of Macallan Ruby single malt.
"And yet, here you are."
Wells's irritation took a turn for the worst. "What is the point of all this? If you're going to try and influence my report on the situation with Dane, you're wasting your time. You lost him, and that's all on you. You lost him first." It was a cheap shot, but Royce couldn't help himself. He halted with the glass halfway to his lips. "What do you want, Victor?" The other man's annoyance mingled with confusion.
"I want you to stop playing games. Why am I here?"
Now it was Royce's turn to be puzzled. "The note."
"This note?"
Wells pulled an envelope from his pocket, identical to the one that Royce had been given only moments earlier. The other man made a show of opening it, revealing the slip of paper within. In the same careful copperplate script, there was a request addressed to Victor Wells to meet here at this time. The note signed off with Donald Royce's name.
"You asked me to come up," Royce insisted, "just now."
Wells shook his head.
"You asked me. I should have refused."
As he spoke, one of the glass panels slid aside. Part of the shadows on the balcony detached, revealing a figure dressed far too casually to meet the Rapier Club's stringent dress codes.
"You're both here," said Mark Dane, "because of me."
Mark had to admit that he enjoyed the moment, the abject shock on the faces of the two men. Wells was the first to react, reaching inside his jacket, but Mark shook his head.
"Don't be stupid, Victor. This isn't a time to be jumping the gun."
"How the hell did you get up here?" Royce demanded with indignation. "You're not a member."
"I'm not,"
Mark admitted, and he nodded down toward an imposing figure crossing the lobby.
"But he is."
Echo Solomon paused to look up at the balcony and tapped a finger to his brow in the sketch of a salute, before heading out into the grey downpour to a waiting limousine. Wells moved toward the old rotary dial telephone in the corner of the room.
I'm calling six. You can consider yourself under arrest, Dane.
Not doing that, Mark shot back, stepping in to block his path. I told you right from the bloody start. I'm not responsible for what happened to Nomad. I'm not guilty.
Mark, began Royce, we can sort this out. Come with me to the cross. I won't allow Wells to make this some personal crusade. We'll get to the heart of things. You say you're innocent, I believe you.
I know you do, Mark replied. He paused, glancing at his watch. He didn't have long. I wanted to come in. I tried to before. But there's a traitor inside British intelligence, he began. That's obvious. It's the only explanation for my op team walking right into an ambush. It's the reason I've been hunted across Europe and back. The Combine knew that Gavin Ricks and Samantha Green were looking into their mole inside MI6. That's why they targeted Nomad, to remove the threat.
And you did a thorough job, Wells shot back.
Mark glared at him, his temper flaring.
Think, you mouthy wanker, if I was the insider, why did I come back after Dunkirk?
Obvious, Wells retorted, ignoring the insult.
Play the troubled survivor bit. Get yourself some desk duty. You could parlay that into access to any number of important intelligence sources.
Except I wasn't supposed to survive, Mark insisted. That's why there was an assassin waiting for me in France. How could he have known where I'd be? He was told where to go by someone on the inside.
I'm taking sides here, Royce said carefully. But understand, we only have your word for that.
Mark glanced at him.
So what about my capture order being suddenly reclassified as shoot to kill? Who did that?
Wells scowled.
That was an error.
Mark shook his head.
No. Someone wants me dead.
And I know who.
Silence fell across the room.
It was Royce who finally broke it.
We're listening, Mark. Tell us what you believe.
I'll tell you what I know, he shot back.
First, Ian Nash didn't die on the Palomino. He was part of the double cross.
His body was found in the wreckage, said Wells. The DCRI recovered it.
You know that for sure, Mark eyed him. You saw data from a French Secret Service computer. What if that was put there before MI6 got to it?
He pressed on.
The Combine recruited Nash. He set up Nomad and used the explosion to drop off the grid. In return, he got a new lease of life as their attack dog.
There's no proof, Wells began.
But Mark silenced him by pulling a folder from inside his jacket and tossing it onto the table. Royce gingerly opened it and revealed a set of black and white photos, stark images of a corpse on an autopsy table. He recognized Nash's face and paled.
The Americans have the body, said Mark.
I'm sure if you ask nicely, they might let you have it back, or maybe not. After all, he was part of a plot to blow up the US president.
Royce's hand went to his mouth. All that chatter we've been seeing from the Americans, the mobilizations, the rumors about some internal shake-up.
That's because of the Combine? How does that connect to Al-Saif?
One uses the other, Mark told him.
The Combine make their money playing off the fear index. Nothing makes cash like a war does, yeah? They use Al-Saif to push up the threat by helping them build bombs and rake in the rewards.
Wells snatched up one of the pictures.
And Nash? If he's responsible for Dunkirk, how did he end up like this?
The photograph showed the bloodless corpse, the ragged exit wound on the side of his head clearly visible.
He reaped what he sowed, Mark said grimly, his hand tensing with involuntary memory of the trigger pull.
All right, Royce rubbed his face. Mark, we can use this. Come back with me. We'll open a full investigation. If Nash was a Combine mole, we can clear your name and get to the bottom of this.
Mark nodded.
He was a Combine asset, he agreed, glancing at the Cabot again. He wasn't the only one. He repeated what Nash had told him on the roof of the Willard Hotel about the warning that had come from MI6. Neither Wells nor Royce spoke as Mark continued, revealing what he had recovered from Novakovich's hard drive. The metadata showing without doubt that someone inside Vauxhall Cross had been in communication with the broker and his Combine Masters. He felt fatigued just by the act of explaining it to them. Problem is, all the email traces in the world don't count for anything unless you can marry them up with a user code. Without that, you can't know who sent the messages. Royce's fingers rubbed his brow. Good God, we have a serious penetration of our operation and no clear sense of where to look. We have to move quickly, but carefully. Mark, do you think you can help us isolate this person? We can call on the techies at GCHQ, have them sift our email servers. Mark shook his head. No point. That data has already been wiped. The mole knows I was onto them. There won't be any leads inside our systems, not now. We're too late for that. Wells sniffed. No data means no way to track this double agent, if he or she really does exist, and I'm not convinced of that. They'll have to be found the old-fashioned way. Royce glared at Wells. And your department will be in charge of the witch hunt, as you've proven yourself so able in the past. Wells returned his fierce gaze with interest. Make your point, Donald, if you have one. You've been trying to cast K-section and the op teams in the worst possible light since this started. You decided Dane was the culprit, and everything you've done has been to fit that assumption. Royce pointed at him. You made me distrust my own men. I'm doing my bloody job, Wells shot back. I told you before, it's not personal, it never has been. I leave my biases at the door. That's why I am exceptionally good at my job. For every weak link I find, there are dozens more dedicated officers who are quietly cleared and commended. But you never hear about that. You only see the ones dragged to the gallows. There was a polite knock at the door of the Alma room, cutting short the confrontation before either man could take it further. There is someone who knows the insider's name, said Mark, and he called out. Come in. The attendant, who had brought Royce his note, opened the door for a tall, imposing man in an impeccable tan-coloured suit, flanked by two watchful and solemn bodyguards. Mr. Pyotr Glovkonin, said the attendant, by way of introduction, before backing out of the room to leave them to their conversation. Glovkonin looked no different from the last time Mark had seen him, still wearing that air of casual supremacy, of being lord of all he surveyed.
I assume there is a good reason for me being here.
The question was addressed to Royce, and the flash of naked surprise on his face mirrored the moment Mark had stepped from the shadows.
What the hell? Muttered Wells.
He knew full well who the billionaire oligarch was, and the suspicions that crowded around him. I sent the message, Mark told the new arrival. You remember me, from Rome? We talked about that weird-looking sculpture. Recall flashed in Glovkonin's eyes.
Ah, yes, the worried man. Hello again. Tell me, was it a woman, after all?
I think you know exactly what it was, Mark shot back, and his tone made the bodyguards tense like dogs whose master had been threatened. Glovkonin's gaze flicked to Royce and Wells, then away. A full smile slipped in to rest on his face.
Coming here was a mistake, and my time is very valuable, if you'll excuse me.
Mark called out as he turned toward the door. The NSA tracked communications from within British intelligence to a weapons broker named Dima Novakovich, all done under the auspices of a group who call themselves the Combine. Glovkonin paused, offering a shrug.
That means nothing to me.
The emails came from a secure terminal at Vauxhall Cross. Mark turned to look directly at Wells. Your terminal, Victor. Royce came forward, as if he had been waiting for those words, his lips twisted in a snarl.
You bastard! I was right!
Wells gaped.
No! No!
He recovered, his colour rising.
I don't work for this criminal!
He waved at Glovkonin. The smile on Glovkonin's face faded.
Watch your tongue, he growled. Or I'll have Misha and Gregor remove it.
Royce prodded Wells in the chest.
You're a bloody traitor!
That's what you wanted people to think, said Mark, keeping his tone steady. From when he had seen the data provided by the Americans up to this moment, Mark had hoped that it would turn out to be wrong, that there was a mistake. His anger and his grief, so closely interwoven by everything that he had been through, pulled hard on him. He wanted to release it, to do violence, to give in to it. Instead, he looked Glovkonin in the eye and went on. The trail that led to Wells was misdirection, but not quite good enough. The actual login identity syncs to Donald Royce. Wells recoiled from the other man.
That's wrong, Royce insisted.
Mark shook his head. Royce used Ian Nash as his man in Op Team Nomad, manipulating intelligence in line with Combine interests. And in turn, you have been running him for them, Mr. Glovkonin.
I find spy stories amusing, said Glovkonin, as he absently brushed a speck of lint from the cuff of his jacket, dismissing it as easily as he did the events unfolding before him. I'm sure somebody who did those things would be careful to ensure no evidence was left of their involvement.
He gestured to his men and walked away.
Good day.
The action was unconscious, instinctive, but both Mark and Wells saw the motion in Royce as he took a step after the Russian billionaire, as if he might offer him some kind of safety. If Glovkonin saw that, he was utterly indifferent to it and kept on walking. The door slammed shut at his back. In the next second, Wells had the short frame Browning pistol he was carrying beneath his jacket in one hand, and with the other, he grabbed at Royce's arm. He forced the other man into a chair and held him there, boiling with cold fury.
Donald Royce, he snapped, biting out each word, you are being detained under the Prevention of Terrorism Act. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention, when questioned, something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence.
Wells stepped back and took up the telephone, dialing quickly.
This is Bravo 8-4, he said. Red call, this location. You stupid blind idiot, Royce muttered. You don't understand.
He looked up and found his former officer looming over him. A gun was in Mark's hand.
Make me, said Mark, his voice loaded with hate. Tell me why you let them do it.
Across the room, Wells saw the Glock semi-automatic in Mark's grip and raised his own weapon.
Dane, he warned.
Royce shook his head.
You're naive, Mark. That's your failing. And the worst thing is, on some level, you know it. That's why you never pushed, never really tried to test yourself. You didn't want to step outside of your comfort zone. You were happy being the bloke in the van, weren't you? Letting all the hard choices be made by people like me.
Did that include killing your own crew?
Ricks, he sighed. He wouldn't back off.
I tried to discourage him, but he was a tenacious sod. Then Green fell into his orbit, and that meant everyone in Nomad was tainted.
Nash was already in place. It had to be done.
Royce swallowed hard and looked up at Wells.
I'm not going to give you anything. You understand that, don't you? I'm not wrong. I'm part of something that makes us stronger. It won't do for me to be dragged through the mud. Bad for the country and the ministry. I'll be discreetly retired.
Mark pressed the pistol against Royce's temple.
Like hell you will. I'm not alone in what I know, Royce shouted. The only way to keep the free world on an even keel is to hold those rabid dogs like Kadir on a chain. Control! We control them. We can. We can manage it.
Royce was unrepentant, and suddenly he had been free to spill out everything he had kept secret. All the things he believed, but never dared reveal.
No one wants chaos. No more murderers crashing airliners into buildings. So there are people who have the power to take control. The Combine are guiding the war on terror because it makes them rich, not because they want to keep us safe, Mark barked at him. What kind of twisted logic are you seeing, Royce? This is conspiracy, treason.
He jammed the gun into the other man's skull, forcing his head toward the table.
It's murder. Dane, Wells repeated.
He can't pay for what he's done if he's dead. At the last second, Mark whipped back the Glock and cracked Royce across the face with it, opening a cut that would leave an ugly permanent scar. He stepped away and spat on the Alma room's elegant carpet. At length, the gun vanished into the folds of his jacket and Mark produced an encrypted, solid-state memory stick. He tossed it onto the table. "That's everything I have. The NSA traces, the lot," he told Wells. "Same stuff I gave to the Americans. Show it to Talia Patel. She'll know what to do." Mark turned to go, then halted. "And do yourselves a favor. Tell GCHQ to tighten up the firewalls on everything, because the Yanks have their ear to the walls." "Where do you think you're going? We can't just walk away," Wells insisted as he made for the door. "You're a witness. There'll be an investigation." "Do it without me," Mark replied, and stepped out into the corridor. A silver E-Class Mercedes-Benz was pulling up outside as Mark stepped around the Rapier Club's top-hatted doorman and down to the pavement. Glofkonin stood beneath an umbrella, held high over his head by one of his Bratvar bodyguards, and not a single drop of rain marred his suit. The other guard was in the process of opening the car's door, and both thugs glared at Mark with unmasked enmity. "Nice ride," offered Mark, ignoring the rain as it soaked into his jacket. He thought about the gun in his pocket and wondered, "Could I draw it fast enough to put a shot into Glofkonin before his meatheads did me in return?" Even after stopping the Washington bombing, ending Nash, seeing Royce arrested and disgraced, the man standing in front of him was going to walk away. "And he's just one part of the Combine," Mark reminded himself, "another link in the rotten chain."
"You're a persistent man, Mr. Dane," said Glofkonin with a wan smile. "That's a dangerous trait to possess."
"You like being untouchable, yeah?" Mark replied. "You think you've earned it?" "Can't deny you're free and clear today," he shrugged. "But what about tomorrow, or the day after? Sooner or later, the Combine is going to find the light on it, and you won't be able to drive away from that." Glofkonin gave him a last look.
"Best of luck," he said,
and vanished inside the vehicle, disappearing behind opaque, armored windows. The Mercedes whispered away onto Grosvenor Street, blending into the traffic. Mark stood watching it, aware of another vehicle sliding to a halt beside him. A door opened at the rear of the black Bentley Mulsanne, and Lucy Keys peered out, scowling at the inclement weather.
"Hey," she called.
"So I guess you need a lift."
"You gonna drug me again?" he asked, without looking at her.
"I reckon we're past that," she replied. "Come on, get in. You'll catch your death out there."
"Not today," he told her.
29. He gave Malt an address in East London, and they set off through the city streets. The rain gave everything beyond a greyed-out, unreal cast. Mark stared out of the window and imagined he was adrift in a sea of slow-moving shapes, the other vehicles around him blocks of abstract colour and indistinct form.
"Can I offer you a drink, Mr. Dane?"
Echo Solomon poured an amount of bourbon and nodded toward the Bentley's minibar.
"I'll pass," said Mark.
He took a breath and then turned to study Solomon and Lucy in the seat across from him. "But thank you for everything you've done to help me through all this." Solomon took a sip from his drink.
"You still do not fully trust me."
He raised his hand before Mark could venture a reply.
"I do not blame you, but it is I who should thank you. We had only part of the Combine's plan when you crossed our path. We knew of the missiles. Until that point, my people had been developing threat assessments based on attacks on airliners. We had no idea they would repurpose the explosive warheads as they did. If not for you, we would have been looking in the wrong place when Washington was targeted."
He shook his head.
"Rubicon failed to stop the Barcelona bombing. We were too late, but not this time."
"You really think you can make a difference in the world?" said Mark.
It wasn't a question.
"We continue to try," Solomon gave a nod, "and I would like you to be a part of that endeavor."
Mark blinked. He honestly hadn't expected to hear that.
You're offering me a job.
Lucy gave a wry smile. He pays pretty well, plus you get good medical and dental.
Your status as an MI6 officer was revoked the moment you went on the run, said Solomon. If you come to work for Rubicon, I can promise you a much higher wage and a better arena for your skills. Tracking and stopping an Al-Saif cell from committing an act of violence on American soil proves to me that you have the qualities of an excellent field agent.
I was just lucky, Mark said, shaking his head. That's half the job, noted Lucy.
Rubicon's Special Conditions Division needs people who are willing to commit to what is right, Mr. Dane.
Solomon put down his glass and gestured at the city passing by.
There are hundreds of other threats out there. Men like Glovkonin, factions like the Combine. The world cannot rely on nation states to prosecute them. Sometimes more direct action must be taken. I would offer you the chance to bring the world some degree of justice.
Justice, the word echoed in Mark's thoughts. I don't think that's what I was looking for. I was in this for revenge, payback for someone I cared about. He saw a dark-haired woman standing on a street corner, and for one brief instant her face became Sam's. I think I still am, he added.
I know this need.
Solomon reached up to his neck and pulled out the silver chain that hung there, holding the metal piece strung upon it in his palm.
At first, it is what I wanted. This is the trigger from the gun I used to kill a warlord, the first evil man I knew. I was only a boy, but I had a man's hate. He murdered the family that raised me. I took his life in payment, but it was not enough.
His eyes lost focus, and Mark knew Solomon was living that moment over again in his memory.
There is always another warlord. There are always other victims who deserve to know justice.
The car had left the main roads, and it slowed as it passed down a narrow, leafy street. Mark saw black railings and red brick walls.
I appreciate the offer, he told Solomon, but I need some time to think about it. Take as long as you wish, he shook Mark's hand. You know where to find me. We will speak again, Mr. Dane. I am certain of it.
Mark climbed out of the Bentley and Lucy followed. The rain had passed, but the streets were still wet, the air still chilly. She glanced up.
Clouds breaking. Sun's gonna come out, I think.
Yeah.
He paused. Look, Lucy, I'm sorry about how this came out, about what Cahill said. Lucy shook her head before he could go on.
Dane, forget about it. Home isn't something I need a passport to prove. It's right here.
She tapped her chest.
You can take the girl out of Queens, but you can't take Queens out of the girl.
He gave a crooked smile and extended his hand. Thank you for saving my life twice, or three times, however many it was.
Hey, who's counting?
Her grip was firm. Then Lucy's expression became troubled.
Listen, I never told you about prison. I should have trusted you with that.
No, Mark shook his head. I don't give a damn about what you did or who you were before. I trust you. You're one of the few people I can say that about right now.
He let go and turned to walk away. Stay safe. She looked up at the brick arch and the open gate beneath. On the other side of the fence, manicured lawns ranged away, framing lines of grey headstones and age-worn statues. Mark anticipated her question, giving her one last look over his shoulder. I've got to say goodbye to someone. Lucy's words proved correct, and as Mark walked out across the cemetery, the sun found its way out and cast the place in a weak summery glow that brought life to the sprays of flowers left by loved ones to mark their sorrows. He had nothing to lay on Samantha Green's grave, but somehow that didn't matter. She had never been one for bouquets and candlelight. She was the type who looked to the moment to know that he cared for her. Sam had shared something strong and vital with him, but at the same time it was fragile. He was afraid that if he looked too hard, if he applied too much pressure to define it, his memories of her would collapse and he would lose what had made her special. Mark crouched and ran his hand over the top of the simple granite marker that bore her name and a heartfelt inscription. Her mother and father were still alive, although she had not spoken often about them. Sam's dad was ex-military, and he had understood the importance of what she did for the country. Mark wondered if that was any comfort to him now. He considered seeking them out, then thought better of it. Sam had lived much of her life in the shadows, and he had no right to draw that into the lives of the people she loved. "I got him," he told her, remembering the moment when the gun had bucked in his hand, remembering Nash's final moments. "There's others, though. That might take a while." After a time, Mark stood up and saw someone coming his way, a serious bearded man in a long coat. "All right, mate," said John Farrier. "Sorry if I'm interrupting." Mark shook his head. "Come to pay my respects." Farrier nodded. "It was a nice service, good turnout." "Was Royce there?" The other man frowned. "Gave a speech." Mark tensed. "He played us all, and he doesn't even think he was wrong." "Royce is done," Farrier told him. "Wells will bury him deep, have no doubt."
"That'll have to be enough," Mark replied, "for now." He took a breath.
"What are you doing here, John?"
"We tailed you," he said. "I thought you and me should have a talk. You forgive me for Rome and getting you in the shit?"
Farrier waved the question away.
"Worked out all right. The old dog has asked me to take charge of K-section while we sort out this mess. Royce's arrest, well, we're left with a lot of pieces to pick up. It's not just him, either. That data you dropped on us means we have to scour the house for any other rats that might be lurking in the basement."
"The Americans will be doing the same," Mark told him. "Combine are going to be on the back foot for a while. Might even force them into the open."
"It's possible," admitted Farrier. "You want to come in and help?"
Back to six.
Before, that had been foremost on Mark's mind. But now the offer was there, out in the open, he found he couldn't reach for it.
"You're talking about reinstatement?"
"Eventually," said the other man.
He shook his head again.
"I'll pass."
"You sure?"
Farrier came closer.
"If you're at large, you are going to make a lot of people very nervous, and I won't be able to help you."
"They're worried I'm going to go the full Snowden on them."
"That's about the size of it."
Mark's eyes flashed.
"Do you know how deep the Combine's reach goes? Can you promise me that someone won't throw me in a cell for safety's sake?"
He nodded in the direction of figures loitering nearby, field officers who had accompanied his old friend out to find him. When Farrier didn't answer, he looked back toward Sam's grave.
"I've lost a lot. That's going to stop now. I'm going to stay off the radar, find my own road, not just for me, but for Kate and her family. I'll put them in harm's way, and that's not going to happen again."
Farrier accepted this with a sigh.
"Yeah. I'll keep an eye on them for you, but for fuck's sake, phone her when you have a minute. Your sister needs to know what went on, and you need to tell her."
He paused, thinking. "Look, all this has pushed the Combine up to the Premier League in terms of threat value. We're going to be actively hunting them now. When I tell you we could use you, I mean it. Unless, of course, you've already signed on somewhere else."
"Not yet," he noted. "I'm considering all options."
"Rubicon," said Farrier, sounding out the word.
"You know where that name comes from?"
"The river in Italy," explained Mark. "A boundary line in the Roman Empire. Julius Caesar crossed it and provoked a civil war."
"The die has been cast," he said. "No turning back."
"Yeah, I saw that movie too.
Your metaphorical point of no return. And that's what Rubicon is, Mark. That's who Echo Solomon is, because for all that man's good deeds and high ideals, he's not the noble crusader he paints himself. Solomon is a very dangerous bloke. He's got a lot of secrets trailing after him."
"I'll bear that in mind."
Farrier nodded once more, turning away.
"Watch your step, mate."
Alone with the lost, Mark closed his eyes and listened to the silence. The mansion on the Bishop's Avenue in Hampstead was off a sheltered drive that had only one way in or out, and the other buildings surrounding it were a full story lower. Pyotr Glovkonin liked the way the other houses seemed to be bowing to the larger building, as if they were serfs paying fealty to a lord. The Mercedes-Benz rolled to a halt, and Glovkonin stepped out, not waiting for Gregor to open the door for him. He didn't want to admit it, but he was barely keeping his anger in check, and his fury was something he didn't often unleash in front of his employees. He had learned the value of self-control and the power of correctly applied force. It was how he had become a rich man. That, and a perfect sense of self-preservation. That ridiculous piece of theatre in the gentleman's club had been a mistake, and he chastised himself for falling for it. But it had served one important purpose, to alert him that the British were turning against him.
"Wait here," he told his bodyguards. "We'll be going to the airfield."
He left them and walked up the steps to the house, pushing open the thick oak door, framed by a pair of faux Doric columns. Glofkonin had known all along that Royce was of limited value. All assets eventually became stale and unusable, but it was a pity that the Englishman had done so prematurely. Glofkonin had contingencies for every possible endgame involving the MI6 officer, designed to deflect attention away from the Combine and its organization, and now those would swing into action. On the road from the Rapier Club, a few calls had set the wheels turning. The Gulfstream jet G Corps kept at London City Airport was being fueled, and there would soon be a flight plan filed to show Glofkonin and his wife had planned a trip to Monaco weeks earlier. The apartment on Saint-Romain would be ready for them, and if the British security services were foolish enough to move against him, it would not be a simple matter. This was not fleeing, he told himself, merely a tactical withdrawal.
Eleanor!
He called out to his wife as he ascended the staircase from the marble-tiled reception. She didn't answer, and as he mounted the second flight of stairs, Glofkonin noticed the quiet. The house seemed strangled of sound, as if it were holding in a breath. Glofkonin paused on the next landing and reached for a telephone that doubled as an intercom system. No tone issued from the handset, even when he tapped the key to connect him to an outside line. He reached for his cell phone. Detailed in gold plate and black glass, the phone had a dedicated hotline that could connect him instantly with his security staff. But where he should have had a full signal, there was only a blacked-out X. Glofkonin knew the effect of a jamming device when he saw it. He turned to look back down the stairs and something caught his eye, something he hadn't seen on the way up. There was an odd shadow by the sofa, just visible from where Glofkonin was standing. He craned his neck to get a better look, and it became clear that he was looking at the body of Erno, one of the other security men he had hired in Moscow. Erno had a halo of dark arterial blood around him. It appeared that he had been shot through the throat at close range. The reason for the silence, then? If Erno, who had been recruited out of the Russian army's Spetsnaz, was dead, then so were all the other men in the building. Was this the British moving against him or the Americans? It seemed unlikely. He knew their tactics. MI6 would have taken him in the car, and a CIA strike would have been loud and destructive. This was someone else. Someone who wanted him to walk in. Glofkonin considered his options. He could retreat back the way he had come, perhaps make it back to the car and find safety elsewhere, or he could press on to the upper floor, where his rooms were situated, where Elena would be. It was true that he was a ruthless man, and it was certainly not beyond him to consider his wife expendable if her life was weighed against his. But Glofkonin was also a proud man, and resentful of any enemy who dared to invade his home and damage his property. If someone was waiting to face him, it would be cowardice not to answer that challenge. He continued his ascent, pausing to open a safe secreted behind a painting of Vilnius Cathedral. He quietly removed a loaded Makarov PM semi-automatic. Then, Glofkonin walked the last few steps up to the master bedroom that filled the house's upper floor. The doors leading to the bedroom were already open, and Elena's bodyguard, a German woman named Jutta, lay slumped in a chair on the landing. Like Erno, she had been shot in the neck and bled out quickly. Glofkonin tensed as he entered the room, the ghost of anger and the anticipation building in him at what bloody ruin he might find. He saw his wife lying on the wide bed beneath gales of cotton sheets, and he froze. At length, she gave a low, airy gasp and turned over, deep in sleep, utterly unaware of what had gone on around her. A soft voice from behind him said,
"That is far enough. Drop the gun and turn around."
Reluctantly, Glovkonin allowed the Makarov to fall to the thick pile carpet at his feet. Hands open and held away from his sides, he turned to find a swarthy, well-dressed man sitting in the chair beside Elena's makeup mirror. The man had the predatory glare of a lion, the chained violence of a killer in his element. The pistol in his hand was an assassin's gun, a Ruger 22-45, modified to mount a silencer. They had never met before now, but Glovkonin knew this man and knew his capabilities.
"Omar Gadir," he said, inclining his head in a greeting. "This is unexpected." "Speak quietly," Kadir demanded, pointing at the bed with the Ruger's barrel. "If she wakes, I'll be forced to kill her." "Of course."
Glovkonin's annoyance at the invasion of his home faded, to be replaced with more pragmatic emotions. He found another chair and sat so he could look the terrorist in the eye.
"Did you leave anyone alive?" "Only the woman. I needed a lure. If you came here to murder me, I am disappointed," said Kadir. "Assurances were made by your group, against my better judgment. I chose to ally with the Combine to advance my work, and you failed me. A meticulously planned operation, thousands of man-hours and hundreds of assets deployed for nothing. Promises from you that this would succeed, all worthless."
"Regrettable," offered Glovkonin, as if he were assessing the result of an unsatisfactory business transaction.
Kadir went on, ignoring his words.
"All this because of your failure to deal with the British agent and the African."
He leaned forward, and his grip on the pistol never wavered.
"Because you were unable to solve this problem, the efforts of Al-Saif to strike against our targets have proven futile. And I am not a man to waste my time."
"Clearly,"
Glovkonin replied. He understood that whatever he said in the next few seconds would determine if his life would end in this room, his neck punctured by a .22 caliber bullet.
"You have every right to be angry, but I suggest we take this opportunity to discuss how to make certain that these sort of complications never occur again."
Kadir raised the gun and aimed it at Glovkonin's throat.
"Speak," he said, "while you still can."
We hope you've enjoyed Nomad, a Macmillan audiobook production from Forge Books. Text copyright 2016 by James Swallow. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.